we've talked a lot over this hour about collaboration. And I think that collaboration looks very different when you have diverse people around the table.
Yeah.
And it looks a lot better. So it's a win-win situation for us to also work on, you know, inclusivity to help us be better as an industry.
Welcome to the Passive House podcast, brought to you by Passive House Accelerator, a catalyst for zero carbon building. For news, inspiration, and connections from all flavors of Passive House, check out passivehouseaccelerator.com. Sign up to receive regular updates about events, get your questions answered, and contribute to the community dialogue. There's loads of free information for experienced professionals and people just starting out on their Passive House journey. We hope to see you at one of our weekly Passive House Accelerator live webinars. In the meantime, here's this week's Passive House podcast. Welcome back to the Passive House podcast. I'm Matthew Cutler-Welsh, coming to you from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland in New Zealand. And welcome back to Zach. Zach, how are you doing?
I am good. Thank you.
And we're welcoming again back to the pod this week, Jay. Jay, how are you?
I am doing fantastic.
And we've got Jay back on the show to bring us the second part of his interview, his great conversation that he had with Maureen Sanchez, now of RDH. So we're going to wrap that up this week with part two. But before we get into that, we've got a few people to thank. Zach, do you want to give a shout out to our sponsors?
Yes, absolutely. So a big thank you to our sponsors who make everything possible for us here at Passive House Accelerator, including the podcast. So a big thank you to our founding sponsors, 475 High Performance Building Supply, Ingui Architecture, Glavel, Minotaur, Partel, Rockwell North America, Stocorp, and Zola Windows. Thanks as well to our champion sponsors, Buizo, Gradient, Icon Windows and Doors, Intelligent Membranes, PH AirSeal, Prosico, and Source 2050. And a big thank you to our stakeholder partner, NYSERDA, the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority.
Awesome. Thank you, as always, to all our sponsors and all our listeners as well out there. And don't forget to check out all the great resources at passivehouseaccelerator.com and also our YouTube channels, including Reimagine, which we want to also highlight a special event coming up early next year, which we're really, really excited about. Zach, you want to do a quick reminder about Reimagine?
Yes, absolutely. So it's March 7th and 8th. This is an around-the-world 24-hour virtual conference. Super excited about it. And so we want to share our reel that hypes it up for you. And we also have a link for it in show notes. It's a video piece that you can share with folks if you want to get the word, spread the word, which would be really helpful. So without further ado, here's the reel.
Imagine you could learn about 24 of the best buildings solving for climate change, instantly become part of a global movement, and gain the knowledge you need to create real change in what you do every day. Join us for a one-of-a-kind, 24-hour, around-the-world, global online happening, Reimagine Buildings 24. We'll circumnavigate the globe, unveiling a new, innovative building project every hour, complete with actionable solution sets, expert insights, and key lessons learned. We'll connect you with peers from around the world and from your region, so you can build the network you need to create buildings that make a difference. We all know that time is of the essence, that climate change is already here, and that today, too many of our buildings are not only making the problem worse, but also leave us vulnerable to climate extremes that are already here. But that's all changing. A global movement is turning it around, reimagining buildings as resilient and healthy havens, as climate solutions. Tradespeople, builders, architects, engineers, developers, policymakers, and just regular people making it happen on the ground on every continent of our beautiful planet. Join that movement at Reimagine Buildings 24.
All right, so please join us.
That's great. Really looking forward to that. Please do join us. Please also share that video, as Zach said. We'll put the link in the show notes, but you can find it on the Reimagine YouTube channel. We're really excited to share Passive House and the potential of Passive House to be a really important part of the climate solution to a wide audience. And that's why we're getting lots of other people, not just the Passive House community, but lots of other people involved in this event. So get others excited about it. We really want to have a really massive event come March 7th and 8th, 2024. All right, let's get back into our interview. We're going to jump straight into it. We're following up from our last week's episode. So if you're listening to this without listening to last week's, I recommend jumping back to the previous episode and listening to part one. But here we go. Let's jump into the second part of Jay's conversation with Maureen Sanchez.
I'm here with Maureen Sanchez of RDH. So I guess it's a two-part question here, but you're talking about actual ways to overcome and become a better energy consultant, and I think that's extremely valuable. But kind of an overall picture of some of the larger obstacles to the adoption of Passive House in general. What could you identify some of those obstacles as well as some of the potential solutions just that you've seen either, you know, convincing developers that, you know, they think it's going to be too expensive and how you say, actually, it's not, like, it's totally feasible, or potentially regulatory problems that you're seeing kind of emerge.
Yeah. Again, not the easiest question, but I guess the first part, which I think is easier, is I think one of the main barriers to mass scale implementation is simply the way we approach the design and construction of our projects. Mm-hmm. This is how we've done it forever, and change is always hard and change is always scary, right? But I think that through that collaborative process, we have done, you know, we have delivered Passive House smoothly on a number of projects independently to the experience of the team, right, on Passive House. And so if we were able to talk a bit more about that process and try to change the industry, you know, to have a kind of shift in the mindset as to how we approach it, which is not, you know, top down, it's not in silo, it's just extremely, like, I know we talk a lot about like integrated design processes and all of that, but think about it even much further, right? What people think it means and where we're actually taking it. It's extremely, extremely collaborative where, you know, almost before the massing is set up, before any rough architectural plans or anything are set, like not even set, but drawn, you do have everybody around the table to say, here's the financial budget we're going to have to split, and here are the energy targets and energy budgets or carbon budgets, right, that we're going to have to work with. Mm-hmm. And starting from there to say, let's look at every single option or every single design element and agree on the optimal solution from the start, right? And then you start designing, you know, in combination rather than in silo, and potentially sequentially, yeah, where if the architect starts first, then some of these design decisions for the mechanical might already be taken off the table. If you don't have enough floor to ceiling height, you might not get a floor by floor ventilation distribution that might have been the optimal solution for your building, yeah, right? And vice versa. So I think that design process is, again, it's something that we've done successfully. It's just that as an industry, I think we need to embrace it a little bit more. But I don't think it's technology holding us back. right? Like maybe, again, the North American market is slightly less spoiled than the European market, mm-hmm. but we already have enough and it's only getting better and better, right? Yeah. So I don't see that as the main barrier that we're seeing straight away, right? I think the first portion is really about process. And if we could, yeah, it's just like if we're able to reconsider and try something different, I think it would get a lot of benefits because it's not just for passive house building. This is the approach you need for every single high performance buildings. But even if it wasn't to be a high performance building, you would probably save time and money with fewer design iterations and, you know, right? Like for me, that collaboration, that, I don't know, maybe enhanced collaboration is what gives you both cost and performance optimization. Mm-hmm. And the more you depart from it, the more you might lose on one or the other or both.
I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, just, you know, what causes the most amount of money to be lost is these delays where you have to, you get 6 months down one rabbit hole and you realize, yep. Oh, we have to turn around and go back. And if you want to do, say, something like something as central to the building as centralized or decentralized ventilation systems, like,
yeah,
if that's not the first decision you're making and it comes up later, it could lead to all, yeah.
And we have seen a fair share of projects, you know, re-questioning, you know, there. How about we switch from one to the other at the middle of CD? Like, well, you know. Not optimal timing. So it's, yeah, that collaboration, I think, will become the industry norm, because as the energy budgets or energy targets mm-hmm. are getting lower and lower, the teams that don't use that approach will be stuck in cycles of iterations where they design and then they check how performing their design is. Mm-hmm. And it won't be enough. So they're going to go back to the drawing board and check again, right? And so I think it will become the norm, but we could definitely have, you know, have a faster implementation. Mm-hmm. The other portion of the question is a bit more delicate, I think, with developers and owners. And it might, you know, warrant, again, another whole hour by itself. But the few things I would say are that I think we've had a really good, we've had really good success with different types of owners and developers in guiding them towards high performance buildings. Not necessarily because of like one argument or the other. I do think that first, every client is different and we have to listen and see where they're at. What are their questions? What are their concerns? And, you know, guide from there. But I think the side where we've been, I think, even more helpful to the industry lately is ensuring that all these, you know, clients or all these decision groups mm-hmm. in different shapes and forms understand the broader landscape of where the industry is going. Because they know what we know today and they know where we were, you know, 5, 10, 20, 30 years ago. But they don't know as well as we know where we're going. And for us, it's clear because we read like all the, you know, energy efficiency standards and every single article that comes out and we have contacts and we get, you know, updates here and there as to what is coming up down the pipeline and, right?
Yeah.
And so I think being able to, again, be that messenger and say, look, I'm not forcing you there, but I need you to realize that what you're seeing is a bit of a narrow vision and we need to expand that too. Here are what future codes will require, by the way, not just locally, but at a national,
yeah.
right? Or a federal level, at least in Canada, we know that's in the work, right? This is what you're facing with the carbon tax. Right. I know today you might not notice it as much, but we already know where it's going. So have you done your business case, including that over the lifetime of your asset? Resiliency, you know, like as any owner has probably seen, but you've seen that we're seeing more and more extreme events between forest fires. Now, even on the East Coast, floods, right? Heat domes, you know, how is your building reacting to this? Which occupants do you have? And what responsibility do you have against, you know, like with your occupants, right? Yeah. Are you paying to rehouse them? Are you like, what's the, is, if it's an office, like, is it impacting your like kind of retention rates, all of that? Again, if they build a new building today or retrofit an existing building, you know, in one go, and they're pouring that amount of money, you know that they're not going to have the financial opportunity to do so within the next 40, 50, 60 years, right? So again, showing them this is what your building will likely face by, you know, 2070, 2080, 2090, which, you know, we have some data. I'm just looking at Toronto right now because that's, you know, where I'm based, but we have future weather files for the 2040 weather, 2040 to 2050, and it's already significantly different. So you can see that if you're stretching that and looking at, you know, the IPCC reports and Meteonorm files, right, that this is going to be significantly different. And you're asking them, well, if you don't have extra money coming in along the way to face all of that, what happens to your building, right? Is your asset falling down in value? You know, like, will people not want to be in your building and go to like other buildings or things like that, right? And so expanding, right? It's like expanding their vision a little bit to say, we think that all of these aspects should be part of your decision. Mm-hmm. And you tell us how you want to prioritize them, how you're approaching that, you know, what type of asset is it and how do you want to manage it? But this is everything you're facing. And when we are, when we act as like that type of messenger, even if we don't have all the answers and we cannot tell a client, you shall do this or that, we tend to have like really constructive discussions with them, because then selling high performance buildings make a lot more sense than just doing code compliant buildings, which will be by definition obsolete a few years after they complete, if not before, right? Like when you see that, for example, again, in Toronto, we're shifting to the next tier of the Toronto Green Standard in 2025. If you're designing your building today, even and you know, get the approval, you're not even completed on a building scale, but your building is already obsolete technically, right? So it's really just helping the community and the decision makers as to what they should consider. And then you'll have different answers from different groups. But at least we are doing our job. You know, this is our responsibility. This is nobody else's responsibility to start bringing all of these elements to the table so that we can truly empower our client groups and decision makers into taking informed decisions today for a building lifespan that will span so far away that I do recognize it's something they can probably not imagine. But we are still asking them, like we are putting them in a difficult position that they have to learn what that means, right? Over that entire period. What they have, what they've done before is they've looked at the past, and the past was a correct representation of what would happen in the future. Therefore, they were able to make informed decisions based on that. But we're taking them in a different spot where this is no longer, this is no longer true. Yeah. And so we have to give them extra tools and extra information to say, you cannot look at the past anymore because that will put you in trouble. This is not representative of the future. Now, here are all the tools and information that we can give you so that even if it's hard and something that hasn't been done as much, can you today make an informed decision on how you should approach the building for the next right? I want to say easily 55 years, because it's 5 years of design and construction, and another 50 years of, you know, operation. So it's,
it's a big
not an easy job.
Yeah.
Exactly. But it's our responsibility, and it works well when we take it seriously and approach it with them with, you know, backed up with data and say, like, look, this is the new reality. Can mm-hmm. we help you navigate it? But it's definitely taking a lot of our clients out of their comfort zone, which I'm very, you know, I have a lot of empathy for, because it's, you know, you're asking them to do things differently.
Yeah. And I mean, it's creating a model that's half a century into the future, which seems kind of absurd, because how can we know? But I guess a similar question I'm just thinking of. So when I started writing for the Accelerator, domestic hot water, the idea of having an electric domestic hot water system was like off the table, way too expensive, completely absurd. And within 4 years, it is now becoming increasingly common. It's going to be standard in a few years. I'm just wondering, are you seeing any other, like, you know, for embodied carbon, are you seeing any materials that might kind of be, you know, have a similar ramp up, where right now they seem a little obscure, maybe too expensive, but hopefully within the next 5 years, they're becoming almost standard?
I don't know if I would dig into the materials, I would dig into certain products, but okay. I think the first step to that journey is that we need to do these calculations. We are used to doing the calculations for operational carbon. We need to do these calculations for embodied carbon just as well, right? Because we hear a lot of rule of thumbs or the other ideas of you should do this, not do that, but we've done enough LCA, so life cycle analysis at RDH, to also know that it really depends on what your building is like and where it is, right? And how it's designed. So these rule of thumbs, as much as they are, you know, quite a few that are maintained, it is difficult to make these decisions without the calculations behind it. And so step one, we have to do the calculations. Mm-hmm. Step two, we have to do the calculations sooner, because we do the calculations like halfway through DD or CD to check how we're doing. But most of the time you have your hands tied as to how much flexibility you have for a change at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so I think we need to do the same growth in the embodied carbon modeling world that we did in the operational carbon modeling world. And then when we get to bring back these calculations really early, where you get to really influence the design, mm-hmm. then you can look at all your key culprits and approach them this way, right? And I'm not going to go into like particular products, but like concrete is still a very, very big one, steel as well. But there's so many things you can do with that, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad, but you need to have you need to do the calculation, you need to know your design, you need to have embedded all the best practices in there first. And then you need to have that info to compile that with all your calculations and saying, okay, this seems okay, this is what I want to do. I am delivering a building within the embodied carbon budget I got given. Right. And we are already working with some kind of cutting edge developers that have set for themselves in their projects an embodied carbon target the same way as we've set themselves for an operational carbon budget.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it's really interesting. But again, that can only happen if we start shifting the process a little bit. So there's a lot more we can do, but you have to do the calculations first to know where you are at, and mm-hmm. also for not you don't want to prioritize the wrong thing if you haven't done the calculations. So yes. Embodied carbon is still extremely important. However, in quite a few provinces, you do have to tackle operational carbon to a wide extent before, you know, embodied carbon start making a bigger dent into that budget, right? Yes. So I'm not saying you only do one or the other. If you can do both, you do both always. But if you were, you know, if you had certain constraints on your projects that meant that you had to do certain design decisions but couldn't go all the way through to your, you know, list of requirements or your Christmas list, right? You need these calculations to back you up to ensure that you can have the biggest impact as soon as possible, mm-hmm. right? It's the same thing between, you know, I'm thinking now retrofit, because we've talked quite a bit about retrofit as well, but, you know, electrifying an existing building versus reducing demand.
Yes.
Well, both of them will be needed, the same as, right, embodied and operational. But for you to know where it's at, what's happening, what is the capital plan, what is the sequencing of all these things, you don't have a rule of thumb that can always apply and be right. Because some of them will be your windows and your roof are failing, replace them tomorrow, then yes, go for an improved enclosure. The other ones are, no, you're not supposed to touch this, and you probably don't want to create additional embodied carbon by replacing products that are, you know, two years old and don't technically need to be replaced straight away. But if we could work on electrification, so it's all these questions where we need to do more. Sorry, I know I'm an engineer. I know I love my calculations, but I genuinely feel that we need a bit more data to start seeing better trends and always come up with the most optimized solution to each building we design. Because yes, we have to cut carbon, but also the timestamp of when the carbon gets emitted is also incredibly important. And you know that these next 10 years are absolutely crucial for us to follow, you know, a slightly better or an absolutely worse path on the, you know, IPCC and, you know, pathways. And so it's about cutting carbon, but the sooner we get to cut it, the more of an impact it also has.
Yes.
Right. And so again, making these decisions as to, I know maybe policymakers might want like one size fit all, or maybe they don't, but you know, sometimes it feels easy to just like, oh, one size fits all. So we're going to do this, then we're going to do that. Yeah. So I'm hoping that with the experience that the industry is getting, that we get to have all these discussions and we can do these early design calculations on the operational and the embodied carbon part to really guide us to, you know, how are we approaching that building? And normally for new build, it's hopefully a bit easier because you have way more flexibility. But for retrofit, what is your plan if ever you cannot do everything in one go tomorrow, right? Yeah. And deciding on that plan early so that then you have the plan until the last day. You get to judge as to how fast you can deliver on that implementation based on, you know, the conditions.
Yeah,
of the building, but you do have that plan that will get you to where you want to be with low operational and low embodied carbon once you've completed all these measures. So you're not going to have to undo a redo or trigger any unexpected consequences along the line, or, you know, along the path. If we're doing one thing without the other, and that actually creates more trouble than it's worth. So
yeah,
it's. Again, right? I feel like it's that not quite 50 years, but it's like you have to plan ahead. You have to look at everything that will happen down the line, including, you know, will you even be allowed by code to replace double glazing with double again? Probably not. You might be tied to triple. Can you replace your gas boiler? Probably not, because, right? So it's all these questions of telling, you know, the client group and the decision makers that what they've done for 30 years, and when they look at the past, this is again not representative to where we're going into the future. And as much as it's already extremely hard on new build, I think that it's just the same gap we have to bridge on the retrofit part is, you know, if you look at any capital plan of any of the existing buildings we have around the planet right now, I am not sure that some of them include any additional money to have new adaptation measures that you're going to need, or new mitigation measures because codes or client requirements or whatever will ask you, right? To get there for their own climate goals. And so if that is already not captured in the plan, then your capital plan is fundamentally, you know, missing money somewhere, and that's going to get you into trouble. So it's not an easy task.
I saw that a bit in Ithaca. I was up last summer. They're doing a whole electrification plan. And I mean, it works with a municipality that small, but when you start to multiply and think about a countrywide projects that would have to do this, it's an enormous expense. It obviously is best at the end of the day, but if you try to do it on the cheap, it's just not going to go well.
So you're right. So do you see what I mean? It needs so much planning, and it also needs, I think, so much understanding of the buildings you're working with, because again, every building is slightly different.
Yep.
Right. And so you do have to consider that. So I feel like there's a lot it might feel a bit daunting at time, but I genuinely believe we have the skills and the knowledge to at least move all of this in the right direction. But we just need, you know, a stronger community, a slightly more vocal community where we're all like in agreement with all of that, and that message gets repeated over and over and over again to governments, to, you know, owners group, just to that, you know, to cement all this.
Capital group.
Yes, exactly. And I feel like once I've heard it enough times, maybe, you know, it'll get a bit easier. It's right. It has definitely changed over the last 10 years. There's no denial that, you know, the time constraint that we have on the climate crisis. So again, the faster we can move, the better it will be. So that's why I'm still like pushing that message out there.
Well, that's why we're all, you know, doing this, because I think something clunked us in the head a little earlier than some other people. And we realized, oh, crap, if we don't move, things are not going to go well.
Exactly. So yes, you got me.
And on that really happy note, I think we've hit our hour, but I did have one more question that I guess is a little, hopefully shorter, because I feel like these have been massive questions that you could expound on for hours. Just because we are doing, you know, RDH wants to, you know, you're just a great spokesperson for the Passive House community. But on top of everything, we want to support more gender diversity in Passive House and construction. And my question to you is, how can we start to bring in a more diverse group of people? What obstacles should we try to clear away so that we can allow that community to really flourish?
Yeah. I am not sure if this is an easier question.
Sorry.
Solving climate change or diversity and joking aside. So it's definitely such an important question and definitely close to my heart, right? Mm-hmm. I'll start with a tiny bit of background where I consider myself lucky based on being raised, you know, brackets, but in quotes, but being raised by the Passive House community, and the Passive House community being a lot more inclusive than other communities that I've seen, I believe. So I think that Passive House and high performance communities, what I mean, is generally better than where we would see everything else. But is it enough? No, not yet. Right. And I have also had my fair share of, you know, discrimination based on gender, based on also literally the discipline I was in, because energy is not as important as structural or mechanical, you know, like, so when you merge all of this, and probably age as well. So when you merge all of this together, it's, you know, I've had my fair share of experience on that, but the way I would approach it is, I think, bringing more awareness to the topic. And again, I think, you know, several organizations like, you know, the Passive House Network and others have been much better in raising that topics. But I was thinking also at conferences and making sure that, you know, we bring different voices from different minorities to the stage so that we start making, you know, diversity the new norm, right? Rather than middle-aged white men as the panel that talks on every, you know, every conference panel. So I think we're getting quite far from that. But again, it's not enough. We need to keep pushing there, keep probably augmenting the voices of minorities. I think another point is access to the industry. So again, I'm wondering with, you know, students or, you know, even working staff, if, you know, making sure we also get access to minorities a little bit more easily, and we are being, we're being proactive about this, not just like, oh, if you want to attend, that's fine. But no, can we reach out to different minorities to try to rebalance the scale a little bit?
Actively recruit.
Yes, exactly. Another item also incredibly important would be mentorship. So I think we're, you know, I've seen this work a lot, internally, you know, within RDH and within other organizations and also externally, but definitely women mentorship to just get extra tips and share things that might not always be discussed in a work environment. But definitely there are still challenges into, you know, having, you know, equality in gender with even just representation in a firm and, how to say that, listening to people equally, I would say. I think we have to work on all these topics. This is incredibly important. But I think the first portion is really just awareness and accountability. And I think that's on all of us, right? Like, minorities don't have to, but can educate and can share their experience so that people that are not in that position can probably try to relate, but also the people that do have privileges, right? From, you know, different backgrounds or different reasons, to do that extra work of trying to remove some of these, you know, narrow glasses, right? Like the narrow vision, the same as what we were talking, you know, about clients and seeing that landscape. It's also on these people to try to become more aware so that we can have that conversation. Yes. And I think the follow-up to that is also getting good data out of that. Because I, I'm going on a small tangent, but I read a pretty infuriating and exciting book on gender inequality, which was technically focused on women, but once you understand the gist of it, it gets expanded to, you know, any minority. And at the core, to start with, there's also a big lack of, in this case, gender disaggregated data, right? And if we're not aware and we don't measure what's currently happening, then it also gets pretty hard to address. Yes. And it's funny because it brings me back to like day one of work and, you know, working with energy efficiency to start with, right? Back when I started my career. And the first mantra that I heard, which is in one of the CIPSE guides out of the UK, CIPSE being the Chartered Institution of Building Services Engineers, and the one
written, so I've never heard it.
Yeah, if not, I'm guessing it's a bit too long, but yeah. So, and one of the CIPSE guides on energy efficiency is you cannot control what you don't measure. And so, you know, no matter if you're talking about energy or, you know, diversity, equality, and inclusivity, and all these things, it still shows you that awareness is still step one. And after the awareness, you need to have data to then be able to work on that and address what you're seeing. So
yeah.
I'm just wondering if there's more we can do to keep pushing all of that, because
building and,
again, you know, time climate crisis, we won't resolve the climate crisis without, you know, social injustice and environmental injustice and all of that. So as much as we might not feel in control or as much in control on other topics, I do believe that they're all really tied together. And we need a win on every single one of these topics to actually make us win overall, because us solving the climate crisis and not, you know, gender inequality or, you know, environmental injustice. Yeah. It's probably not going to work. It's probably still not a win at the end of the day. So I think there's a lot we can do, and we all have a voice, right? Like the Passive House Accelerator, especially, but every one of us within even our work, the decisions that we made, the project that we follow, the approaches that we recommend to the client, and the recommendations, right? And the wording that we use. Again, I think it's our responsibility to keep working on all these topics, even if at the core of it, we are working with buildings. But I think our impact can be a lot broader than that.
Well, that, I think, is a absolutely wonderful place to end. Just thank you so much for taking this. We went way over time.
It's so good. I'm always excited to share all of this with people, because it's, right, it's these conversations that remind us of what we can do together as a group, as an industry, and where we want to go. Because sometimes, you know, probably engineers first get bogged down into the nitty-gritty of calculations, but at the end of the day, we're all here to pursue the same goal, and we're better and stronger together. So that's, sometimes it takes some of these conversations just remind yourself of where we're at and what we can do, and, you know, to always have our North Star shining over there and guiding us.
And that was Maureen Sanchez of RDH, wrapping up that second part of a great conversation. Jay, final comments from you. What was your standouts from this part?
I think what really stood out to me was her conversation about how, when she's working with developers and building owners, about how, you know, they really need to not be building for 2023 or 2024, even 2025, but for, you know, 2050 or 2060. And not only that, you know, the codes are going to become more stringent in a lot of municipalities, but just that the climate itself is going to change, and that if they're not taking these things into consideration, you know, their building will be obsolete. So it's not just about, you know, trying to build an efficient building, but trying to build a habitable building and a durable building. And I think this really speaks to, you know, particularly organizations like schools, that, you know, these are long-term investments that they're making. They're not building an apartment building and then selling it off to somebody else. I mean, these are going to hopefully be housing students for sometimes decades to come, maybe even 100 years. So they really need to be thinking about it as a long-term investment. And I thought Maureen was very, very clear about that and really, really made some interesting points.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point about the time span, particularly of these larger projects that are in early concept design stage right now, probably not going to be built for another 2 or 3 years, and codes are changing. So if you're not thinking about future codes and you're only building to today's standards, there's a good chance that a building some buildings will be obsolete, as Maureen puts it, even before they're finished, as in the code will have progressed so much beyond that. And also, I think it's a really good point that we have the data. I mean, we have they are projections, but we do have future climate files. People are starting to develop these, and we have scenarios, and so we're able to model with different weather files from history, because we can't just rely. We know that we can't just rely on the past to predict the. Well, we can kind of rely on the trend of the past through to the present, and then extrapolating that out to the future. But we need to acknowledge that that's not a flat line. It's a change, and we need to make sense to be designing those buildings anticipating that change. Otherwise, it's going to be increasingly uncomfortable. Zach, what about you?
Well, I was struck by her discussion of the importance of collaboration early, basically integrated design, and how energy modeling and, you know, passive house modeling, for example, needs to be part of that, you know, very early. So we're making smart decisions when it's cost effective to make those decisions, not when it's too late and things become so expensive to change. But what I thought was particularly insightful was to then extend that as well to this new arena of embodied carbon, and that we need to do the same sort of thing of making embodied carbon calculations, and we need to do them sooner than we've been doing them, so that we can make the same kind of cost-effective decisions around embodied carbon, and whatever design tweaks or changes in specification for a better concrete mix or whatever the case may be. So I thought that was a kind of a logical and maybe not completely obvious progression of this integrated design collaboration, do it in model early ethos to include embodied carbon.
Yeah. I like it, the term extreme collaboration, to be extremely collaborative. Because it's a nice word, collaborative and integrated design, but really thinking about what does that mean and who needs to be in the room really, really early on. That idea of having a financial budget, which we're all familiar with, you got to get the project financed, you got to have a budget, but you've also got a carbon budget. So while with your financials, you're also looking at carbon and weighing up operational carbon and embodied carbon at the same time, because choices in products and materials will impact both of those. And it makes a lot of sense to be thinking about those as budgets that you have for the building at the same time. And in our case here, that is actually a reality. I mean, we have now legally binding reporting for some companies for Scope 1, Scope 2, and even Scope 3 contributions to greenhouse gas emissions, which means that people in some parts of the world are actually now legally obliged to do carbon accounting alongside their regular financial accounting. So that's coming. So it pays for people to start getting ahead of the game there. Something that you mentioned last week, Jay, we talked about Maureen being a real leader, and she talked a bit about her role as a young female in the industry, and that just really, in my mind, underlines how much of a champion Maureen has, because not only has she been at the forefront of getting people to do things differently, to think differently, and to do passive house where passive house wasn't done, but to do it as a young female in the construction industry probably is another potential hurdle. But I think we can all tell from Maureen's passion and enthusiasm and her personality that she has been a real driving force in that, and just acknowledge her for the work that she's done in that area.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, I also like the idea of her, leaving the desk behind as somebody who's doing a lot of modeling and they're obviously mostly at a computer, and actually getting out in the the world, and you know, speaking with the team who's on site, I think that was really valuable for her as well. And you know, I don't think she explicitly said it, but it seemed like that could be a great experience for other young you know, engineers and architects to really take that into consideration.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that stood out for me was the idea, she mentioned a couple of times, of being raised by the Passive House community and this concept of mentorship and a real sense of a community, you know, broader sense of community. And I think it was nice to hear that and how Maureen portrays that in her journey in coming across Passive House and sort of the early learning and then the people that she's met. But I think that's something that we can really leverage on. I think that's something that the Accelerator is helping to do as well. But it's been a common thread for Passive House conferences and Passive House people getting together and helping each other out. But I think it's something that we can think about how we do more of to help raise people up, whatever stage of their career they're at. And really support each other through mentoring and through collaboration and supporting, helping each other out. So yeah, I think just something to think about as a community, how we want to carry on doing that as more and more people get involved.
No, I've always I really have always appreciated how welcoming and also collaborative the Passive House community and as a whole is, and it's just. Yeah, it's very cool to see that Maureen went from, you know, being a mentee and is now most certainly a mentor to a lot
absolutely,
of people.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you, Jay. Really appreciate you getting behind the microphone, people getting to hear your voice. I'm sure others will appreciate that. We should do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to.
Any closing thoughts from you, Zach?
No, thank you, Jay. That was awesome. And we're here near the end of the year, and in terms of what's coming up for the Accelerator, in addition to, of course, Reimagine Buildings 24 and March 7th and 8th, we will take a couple of weeks off and we'll be back with our regular Wednesday programming for Passive House Accelerator Live on January 10th. We'll be kind of recharging and gearing up for what's going to be a very big year.
Awesome. Look forward to it. All right. Yes, don't forget to share Reimagine with everyone you know. It's going to be a fantastic event. But until next time, thank you for listening in, and we'll be back soon on Passive House Podcast. Thank you, guys.